I appreciate you guys inviting me here to speak today, and we're going to talk about step four. But I think it's good to take a minute and kind of continue the discussion that was going before the end of the hour, and just take a perspective of where we're at. I'm going to be talking as if I'm talking to somebody that's getting ready to take a step four. Let's just say where we're at, where we've just finished saying that we're going to turn our life and our will over to the care of God as we understand God. And that means, we've done these first three steps, which are generally called the decision steps. And the decision steps don't require a whole lot of action in their own right. One, two, and three, we admitted in one that we were powerless over food and our lives were unmanageable. And two, we decided that a power greater than ourselves, a higher power, God, could restore us to sanity. And in three, we decided we were going to let this higher power restore us to sanity. We were going to turn our life and will over to the care of that higher power. Now we're about to move into the action steps, 4 through 9, where we're going to learn how to do that. And by learning how to do that, what I'm saying is that we're going to learn and practice a spiritual way of life. We're going to say that. Got a good look at myself here. I need to straighten my collar. And we're going to begin to practice this way of life that leads us to a better relationship with God. Now, why are we doing that? Why are we moving into that spiritual way of life? For a long time, I thought just having turned my life and will over to God's care, that ought to be enough, hadn't it? If God can control my food for me, why do I need to move into this other phase of recovery? And as a matter of fact, that worked for a while for me. I came in, I did the first three steps. Turned my life and will over to God's care. They said, come to a lot of meetings and enjoy the fellowship and here's some tools. And I managed to lose a lot of weight on that basis and I managed to stay abstinent for almost 2 years with that, without moving forward with the steps. I made a couple little short runs at it, but nothing really serious because the rest of it was working. So why should I move on? And I heard stories of people, becoming raw when they peeled off the onion layers too quick in step four, and the pain they thought drove them back to the food. And I thought, why move forward? Why hurt myself? Why expose all this inner turmoil? What's that got to do with my eating? And if the fellowship was working and the tools were working, then I didn't understand. I didn't see the necessity of moving forward. But the fact of the matter is that for me, and I think for most of the people that I know, I suppose there's not a universal law here, but it seems to me that is usually a short-term solution. That what happens is that we get some momentum in terms of our abstinence. We get some momentum in terms of our recovery, but we always hit a tripping point. We hit what I call speed bumps in life, and when we hit those speed bumps, if we don't have the momentum, if we don't have the program, it's going to trip us and it's going to throw us off track. And I believe if you're a compulsive overeater like me, you're going to be back in the food. Harlan says that we have to learn how to avoid the buildup of normal human emotions. And the big book talks about how we how the steps would put us in less danger of worry and upset and resentment, those things that lead us back to practicing the disease. And so the practice of this spiritual way of life, the development of these skills in the spiritual way of life are designed to stop that buildup of human emotion, and they're also designed to get us closer to this higher power, so that the higher power can work in our lives. And it also gives us a substitute for, when I have an upset, I want to soothe that upset. Nobody likes pain. I don't like emotional pain. I don't like fear. And so my tendency is to turn towards those, to turn towards this a solution, any solution. Food was a solution. Alcohol was a solution. Inappropriate relationships were a solution. But guess what? They were not great solutions. What we're doing now is we're deliberately developing a better solution. And that better solution is the ability to turn to God, to turn to that higher power, to say, "Thy will be done, not mine." To say, "What would you have me do? How can I be of service to you and others, so that we are in less danger of succumbing to the compulsion to eat?" We've also got this idea of momentum. I watch. I sponsor a lot of people. And the a lot of men, and I've watched this happen. There's certain big tripping points, common tripping points. People come up to they'll do the first three steps, and they come up against the fourth step, and they become cautious. Either their perfectionism kicks in, that was one of my problems. Their perfectionism kicks in, or their fear kicks in, and they hesitate and they stop and they lose momentum. And one of the hard things is when you lose momentum, it's hard to back up. If you imagine driving down a road and you come to a speed bump and you stop, it's hard to back up in life and take another run at it. So now you're climbing over the speed bump without the momentum you had coming down the road. And these speed bumps can become huge in our minds, and they can stop us and slow us down. And I think one of the axioms of this of a spiritual way of life is that there is no standing still. You're either growing or you're dying. There's no getting to a point and saying, "This is good. I'm good right here. I'm going to stay right here." We can't stay right here. And so the third step, or between the third and the fourth step, is one of the big speed bumps. The ninth step is a big speed bump. And then I think sponsoring is a big speed bump. I've lost a lot of people. They get through the ninth step, and then they don't want to do, they don't want to take on the discipline, the daily disciplines of 10 and 11. And I've seen them, they, even when they'll want to take on some the disciplines of 10 and 11, they'll say, "I'm not able to sponsor. I'm just not, that's just not me. I'm not going to sponsor." And eventually they go back out. But the one we're going to talk about today is this fourth step. And the fourth step, says, that I'm going to take an inventory. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to look at these things that are blocking me from my power, from my higher power. And we're going to get down to some specifics about how to do that. But, one of the things that stopped me the first time into this was my perfectionism. Perfectionism is a common character defect among us, and the big book talks about how we claim spiritual progress, not perfection. I don't think it's an accident that that's in there, because I wanted to be, having turned my life and will over to God's care, I wanted to be a spiritual giant. You know, I wanted to say, great, I've done this now. You know, the heavens opened up and I was struck with a new vision and everything is perfect. And it's not. It's simply not that simple. And I wanted to write the perfect fourth step. I've got a secret for you, some news. When you do your first fourth step, when you do your 10th fourth step, you're not going to do it perfectly. I'm not going to talk about right and wrong, because there's only one wrong way to do it, and that's not to do it. But you're not going to do it perfectly. You're going to miss things. You're going to not see some obvious things. Hopefully, maybe a sponsor can help you see those things. But it's just not possible to be human and to do it perfectly. And that's okay. You know, I always joke that I spent 6 months that first time through looking for the right pen and paper to do my fourth step on. And while that sounds funny, it's actually the truth. You know, I wanted to write it with the right pen and the right paper and with the right form. I wanted to go through it, and I wanted everybody that saw it, including my sponsor, to say, wow, that was profound. You did a great job. And let me tell you, that perfectionism damn near killed me. You know, it just damn near killed me. Now, I was sitting in a meeting one time, and it was an AA meeting. It was they call it the big meeting here. And one Friday night a month, they have most of the groups here in town come together, and they have one big hall, and they bring in a kind of a conference level speaker, and somebody pretty interesting, not like me, but somebody interesting, and everybody goes and listens to him. And this one night that I was there, and the speaker had sobered up in Dr. Bob's house back in the day. And this was in the 90s. This guy was so old that he was blind, and they had to hold him up to the podium. They had two young guys standing on either side of him with a hand under his armpit, holding him up where he could speak. But he was a powerful speaker, very powerful speaker. And he talked about coming to his first AA meeting, and he walked in, and he said he'd been drinking the day before. You know, this was in the 30s, for God's sake. And he'd been drinking the day before, but this was Friday, and he hadn't had a drink that day. And he came to the meeting, and he sat and he listened to the speaker, and the meeting was over. When the meeting was over, a couple of guys grabbed him. They called them guides back then. They didn't call them sponsors. And these guides took him to the back of the room, and they sat down with him. Excuse me. And they said, okay, you're here. So we assume that means that you know you can't control your drinking. And the guy said, yeah, I've tried to stop, and I can't stop. And on my own, and I'm hoping you guys can help me. And they said, okay, that's step one. Said, step two, do you believe God can help you? And the man said, I told him that I thought God could help me if he would. And they said, well, that's step two, that you believe God can restore you to sanity. And then said, so are you willing to pray with us and turn your life and will over to God's care? And he did so. He prayed with him and turned his life over to God's care. And so then they took out a bar napkin and a felt tip pen, a grease pen, and said, okay, now we're going to do your inventory. And so they said, tell me what you've done. And the guy said, "Well, I told this lie and that lie and this lie." And they wrote liar on the napkin. And he said, "I stole this, I stole that, I stole this." And they wrote thief on the napkin. And it said it went like that for a little bit. And they said, "Now we want to talk about why you did those things you did." And he said, for the most part, as he looked through those things that they'd inventoried, he said, "I realized that," he said, I stole not because I needed those things, but because I wanted them in order to make myself look good. And I lied not because I had to tell the lie, but I did it to make myself look good." And he said, I realized that at the root of most of what I'd done was an effort to make myself look good, to make my people think more of me than I thought of myself. And I realized, sitting there listening to him, that applied to me as well. And the guy went on to tell the rest of his story. And amazingly, he was out over the weekend making amends for the things he'd done, you know. And we come to this program, and a lot of times we get stalled in these speed bumps, and we get stalled with these, with our, you know, flowery forms and workbooks and all this stuff. And we make something out of this step process that it isn't designed to be. And we take years to do what should take days. And, you know, and part of that's our perfectionism, and part of it's our just not having good guidance, and part of it is just not understanding that we need to move through this. We need to move through this little training process and learn these skills and to move on to where we can live in steps 10, 11, and 12. You know, the growth steps, the maintenance steps, however you want to label them. But, you know, the way that pyramid should look is the overwhelming majority of us should be living in steps 10, 11, and 12. And the newcomers, the fairly new people, should be going through this training process of 4 through 9, learning how to do those inventories and learning how to do those appraisals that are a part of 10, 11, and 12, so that we can live the spiritual way of life. And so I'll get off my soapbox and get back to, so, you know, about 5 years ago, when I came back hard into the program, when I hit what I hope is my lowest bottom, my last bottom, I did my fourth step, you know, just to talk about how it can be. It was, I did the fourth, fifth, and on through the ninth. I'd made all my amends, and I had gotten a great deal of relief out of that. I'd gotten a great deal of recovery. I'd moved forward a great deal in my way of life. But I was looking for a coat, and I opened up a closet I don't normally open up in my house. And in that closet was hanging my letter jacket, and my letter jacket from high school. And I looked at the letter jacket, and I lettered in football and I lettered in basketball for 3 years, sophomore, junior, and senior years. It was a 4-year high school. And I immediately remembered that I should have had a letter for my freshman year. I played on the varsity. I was the tallest kid in the school and the tallest kid on the team. I didn't start, but I played a lot. And at the end of the season, the coach said, he said, you really earned a letter this year. You contributed more than a lot of kids that are going to get a letter, but I don't letter freshmen. And so I'm not going to give you a letter. And I resented that. And the minute I pulled that letter jacket out, that resentment became fresh. Now, I graduated high school in 1969, and this was 5 years ago. So we're talking like 45 years that resentment had been in the back of my mind. And it came fresh when I pulled that letter jacket out and looked at it. And I'd not put it on my fourth step, you know. I'd not put it on my fifth step. I had not put it, you know, in my amends thoughts, you know. But guess what? The point of that is that it wasn't too late, you know. Just because I hadn't thought of it and I hadn't done it, doesn't mean I can't go and clean it up. So when we're getting ready to do this fourth step, the idea that we're going to do it perfectly, the idea that we're going to catch all of the issues, and that we're going to write some fourth step that deserves to be published in whatever that would be published in, needs to be let go of. We're going to do the best we can do. We're going to get down everything we can think of, and we're going to know that we're practicing a skill that we can use later if we remember something to come along. And it's okay. You know, it's okay if it's not perfect. It is quite all right if it's not complete. It's the best we can do. It's progress. It's not perfection. And so we're going to get started with this process. We're going to say, you know, we're going to make some lists here, and we're going to be as quick and thorough as we ought to be. And what I tell my sponsorees is, you know, that they have 24 hours to get these lists done. And the first thing we're going to list is our resentments. And, you know, I've had people say, I don't have any resentments. I'm a kind of a go along kind of guy. I'm easygoing. I don't have any resentments. And to that, I'm going to say bullshit. And, you know, if you're a human being in this world, you have resentments. And you know, how many you have, that may be different from person to person, of course, but most of us have a resentment. And what are, but sometimes the reason we don't think we have any is we don't really understand what that word means. You know, the word resentment means refeeling. A resentment is a resentiment. It's a sentiment, a feeling that we won't let go of, that we've held on to, you know, like the letter jacket for 45 years. It is a it's a excuse me, I'm choking here. It's a it's a feeling that can be, negative usually, but that we're just holding on to, and we're not dealing with. Seeing that, so what I suggest to a lot of people is that they substitute, I'm mildly irritated at somebody. Okay, well, I'm mildly irritated at a lot of people. Well, write those down. Let's call those resentments. Let's call those a feeling we won't let go of. So we list all of our resentments. We list all those people, and we ought to, might as well start with our family. You know, we start with those people that are closest to us, because chances are, if it's you know, your parents or your children or your brothers and sisters, that you're going to have some resentments toward them. That doesn't mean you don't love them. That doesn't mean that you don't think a lot of them or think highly of them. It means that there's some rub between you, because you're close. You know, rubbing is racing is the term in NASCAR. You know, that if you're close to somebody, you're going to rub up against them, and they're going to rub you the wrong way sometimes. So put them on the list. Just put them on the list. You can take them off later. You know, you can take them, you can cross through them. It doesn't mean it, you know. One of the things that I did when I was first trying to do this, without great guidance, was I sat down and said, now, if I put this person on my fourth step list, there's a chance they're going to end up then on my ninth step, and I'm going to have to make amends to them. So if I don't put them down here, then I won't have to do that later. So I was trying to control the process, and I was trying to control the process by leaving people off, dealing with it. So, in other words, I was trying to control the outcome, and that's not recovery. That's not gonna get me what I need. I have to have the attitude of God, whatever it takes. You know, whatever you want, whatever I need to do, whatever is required, I'm ready to go to any lengths. You know, if I'm willing to go to any lengths, then even though it's a parent that I love, I'm going to write them down. You know, even though it's somebody that I don't like, and I know that I'm going to end up having to make an amends to somebody I don't like, I write them down. I write them down because it's the pathway to health. It's the pathway to mental health and recovery. So we put them down. We get them on that resentment list. So then we've made the resentment list. Now we're going to make the list of our fears, the second of three lists. That list is things I fear. Now, you know, I was full of false bravado. You know, I'm 6'4", and you know, in my prime, I was a fighter. You know, I fought people off. I never backed away from a fight in my life. And, you know, and I said to somebody one time, you know, I'm 6'4", I can whip my weight in Wolverines, and I carry a pistol most of the time. So, you know, I'm not afraid of anything. And they said, if you're not afraid, why are you carrying the pistol? And I had to back up a little bit and ask myself, you know, why do I have this false bravado? Isn't that a sign of fear? You know, if I have to be like the bird or the animal that, you know, flares its colors to scare people away, isn't that a sign of fear? You know, and here again, sometimes substituting some words helps. We're going to write down what we're afraid of. Well, let's say that we're going to write down things that we're mildly concerned about the outcome of. You know, we don't have to call it fear. If the word fear has a reaction, if I have a reaction to that, then let's call it I'm concerned about the outcome. I can say I'm afraid of of old age. I'm afraid of my retirement. You know, maybe it's easier for you to say I'm mildly concerned about the outcome. Put it down. That's really a fear. It's the same thing, but those words sometimes, you know, we're kind of, I can speak for myself, but you know, I've got a picture of looking up here, John Wayne on the wall, and John Wayne is, you know, was kind of that, at least his image was kind of that thing that I was raised to have, you know, that John Wayne swagger. You know, I'm not afraid of anything. So writing down a list of fears seems to take away from that, my self-image. And so, you know, but I can say I'm mildly concerned, if that's what I need to say. So we write down our fears in this list making that we're doing. And then the third thing is not as clear in the big book, you know, some discussion and dependent on other literatures. We're going to write the third inventory. It says it's about sex, but it really is about sex harms, and it's probably more about relationships harms. You know, somebody, people can get confused. I got confused, you know, about I've harmed people in relationships without having sex with them. You know, I can be harmful in flirtation. I can be harmful in any form of relationship. So in the but in the third inventory, I think that it's meant to include all my harms, however I harmed people. And you know, that sex is it's kind of almost a Freudian use of it, you know, that it's, you know, sex is behind everything. So every relationship has a sexual component, but we're going to make that third list. And in my opinion, everything on that list is, should be people I've harmed. And that list is going to be going to determine a lot of our night step work, of course. But again, we don't want to worry about that. If we have surrendered to this power greater than ourselves, then you know, we have to be fearless, and from the very beginning, and like how it works says, you know. So we write down the people that we've harmed, and we get ready to go to the inventory. Now, on the second day of this process, my sponsor gave me 24 hours at this point to finish the entire inventory. And once the list is made, then we sit down and we work across. We do the columns, you know, and the columns are laid out for us in the big book. And I know that there are forms out there, and I know that there's people that are, you know, they push, you know, some this guru or that guru and this form or that form. And I have nothing to say about those forms, you know. What I can tell you is that there's enough information in the big book to do this process and do it right. And that it is the source, and millions have recovered with no other resource other than that. And so we go across, we write the cause, we write what's affected, like, you know, our self, sex relations, self-esteem, personal relationships, pride, my ego. My ego is usually always affected. And then the fourth column, which you have to skip over a couple pages to understand, on page 67, he says, return to the list again. We put our minds, put out of our minds a wrong others have done, and resolutely look for our own mistakes. This is the fourth column. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other persons involved entirely. Where were we to blame? You know, this stopped me. This is another attempt through the years. This was a problem for me. I looked at some of these people, and I said, when it comes time to make, I'm going to have to end up making amends to these people. And why, you know, if I did them wrong, if I hurt them, but once, and they hurt me three times, then why should I even deal with that here? You know, isn't the slate clean? Didn't their harm to me somehow balance my harm to them? And the answer to that is no. There's no recovery in that thought process. You know, the recovered thought process is, first of all, it brings me to mind the what used to be called the Doctor Alcoholic Addict, but now it's called the Acceptance Chapter. And in the Acceptance Chapter, in the stories in the back of the big book, Dr. Paul writes about his new pair of glasses, and he says that that he had to turn his glasses around, his magical magnifying glasses, that his magical magnifying glasses had magnified other people's faults and minimized his own faults. And so when it comes to harms, my glasses, my magical magnifying glasses, magnified what other people had done to me and minimized what I had done to them. In other words, I have no judgment in that regard. What's important is what's blocking me from God isn't what other people did to me. What's blocking me from God is what I did to other people. My guilt is more likely. Excuse me. My guilt is more likely to be to be my tripping point than a lack of forgiveness. So we write down those things that these people, we put down what we did. You know, we may have put down that we resent them and why we resent them, but now we're going to get down to what did we do to them, you know. And in particular, we're going to pay attention to what did I do to maybe get the ball rolling? You know, how did I get this thing started? How did I not cut it off when I may have had an opportunity to cut it off? You know, they said something snippy to me and I said something even snippier back, you know, where I could have said something peaceful back to them, something that cut it off. You know, why did I escalate the situation? You know, I've been learned to take this process to work with me. You know, I'm a estimator, contract manager for a construction company, and I've become quite aware of a lot of the fights that I've gotten into with architects over the years. Are things that I could have cut off in the beginning. They did something I didn't like, and instead of de-escalating the situation or taking the small little hit that it would have taken to just go along, I've escalated the fight. And then they escalated the fight back, and it's become a small thing has become a big deal, a big fight. And, you know, it's the same in life. You know, I have a poor relationship with my brother, and a lot of it has to do with how hard headed both of us are. And so, you know, he did something I don't like. I did something he doesn't like. Instead of de-escalating the situation, we've escalated it each time. And our politics are polar opposite. Our religious beliefs are polar opposite, and we have a lot to disagree about. And I've taken some great pleasure at times into making snippy comments to him, and you know, and now it's gone so far that you know, it's difficult to go back and repair all that, and I've made my efforts and he's made some efforts, and we try and you know, and I mourn the loss of time, I mourn the loss of that relationship, but that gives me an understanding of what we're trying to accomplish in that fourth column. You know, we're trying to accomplish we're trying to turn those glasses around and see what we've done to feed this situation, what we've done to make it grow, and that's going to help us to build better relationships with other people, and it's going to help us to maybe repair this relationship back later on. So we've done all these things. We've done the resentments, and we've done the fears, and we've done the harms, and then there's a fourth thing, and it's listed in the big book, and that is that when we're done with all that, we write down our relationship ideal. Some people call it the sex ideal, but we say, you know, my ideal. And what we're trying to say is, how do I want to show up in my primary relationship if I have one, or my primary relationship if I'm going to have one? How do I want to show up? You know, how would I be? And that is the goal that's called out in the book. So, having done all that, and I'm going to wrap up here pretty quick so we can take some questions. Having done all that, I'm going to suggest that there's an implication in the big book about step 4.5, and it may be a little bit vague, and you may not see it at first, but I want to quote step 5 to you. Step 5 says that we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Somebody else will come on here pretty soon and do step 5, but the first time through step 5, one of the tendencies we have, and I certainly had, was to want to just read my step 4 to somebody. And that's not what the step says. It doesn't say I read my step 4 to another human being. It says that we admitted the exact nature of our wrong. Now, how do I know what the nature of my wrongs are? What I think that implies is that I've gone back through these resentments, these fears, and these harms, and I've looked for common causes and conditions. I've looked for the principles that were involved. I'm going to give you an example from my own history, and that is I had a resentment towards most women. You know, I had a resentment towards women that left me, you know, an ex-wife, a primary relationship or two that didn't work out, and to my mother, and that was the resentment. My fear was that not only that I would never have a lasting and intimate primary relationship, but that I wasn't capable of such a thing, and that the reason I wasn't capable was that I was unlovable at my core. I've certainly heard that enough in the rooms, but I believe that to be true about myself. I had some evidence of that, and so that was my fear. And the harm that I had done was that I had I had used women without good intentions, and whether it was just flirting with women to get attention, or whether it was actually going through with the relationship, it wasn't because I had serious intentions. And then one of the other things that I saw when I was doing my inventory and came to harm was that I told a lot of what I consider to be small lies. And by that, I'm going to tell you that I already talked about my letter jacket, but I was a pretty good basketball player in high school. I had some games where I made 44 points, was the highest I ever made. I did that 3 times. I averaged over 26 points a game my senior year of high school. But what I would tell you was, I'd tell you that I was a all-state basketball player in high school. And the truth of the matter was that one little hometown newspaper had put me on an honorable mention list for an all-state honor, but I wasn't on the big all-state list. And the truth was also that I had talked to a couple of Division I basketball teams, but they all told me the same thing. I was too short to play forward and too slow to play guard. And, you know, that one of them said I could come and make good deal. But, you know, I tell that story a little different. Now, what does that have to do one with the other? What this common causes and conditions told me was that that I had a self-esteem issue. I had an ego problem. You see, the reason I had these relationships with these women was that I had this feeling, this idea, that if that woman would pay attention to me, if that woman would sleep with me, that I must not be as fat, ugly, unlovable as I thought I was on the inside. That somehow, you know, that would shore up that self-esteem. And the same reason I did that is the same reason I told those lies. You know, that if I could tell you that, that I was an all-state basketball player, then I could make myself feel better about myself, because now I thought you thought more of me than I thought of myself. And so therefore, you know, by finding that common cause and condition, what I began to see is that I had an ego problem. An ego problem is a self-esteem problem. And a self-esteem problem is an ego problem. And that I had looked to the wrong things to shore up my self-esteem, my flagging self-esteem. And as I went through the process in 6 and 7 of turning over my character defects, I got to work on, think about that issue. And when I got into 8 and 9 and made amends for the harms I'd caused, I got to look at that and say that I harmed people in close relationships because I thought I was unlovable, I wasn't intimate. Because I thought I was unlovable, I wasn't as close to my children as I thought as I needed to be. You know, it led to all kinds of behavior for which I needed to make amends. And so that in step four, while I'm doing step four, it's a good time to begin to look for those common causes and conditions, and a good time to start looking towards how I can right that ship, and how when I get into living in 10, 11, and 12, I can see those things come and I can catch myself in the middle of them and I can correct the action. You know, I took some flight lessons at one point in my life. I never got my pilot's license, but I was learning to fly, and the flight instructor kept talking about small corrections. You know, that what happens is people get themselves in situations when they're flying where they have to make, yank the yoke, where they have to make fast, big corrections. And that's true driving down the road. You know, we don't think about it, but if we wait until we're half in the ditch, we're more likely to have a wreck than if we're making the small corrections as we go, you know, keeping it between the lines, right? So it's the same thing here. And I can begin now, as I'm living my life in 10, 11, and 12, to see when I'm getting off course and make a small correction, get the car back on the road and not have to yank the steering wheel. And so I see that I've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to give people an opportunity for questions. So I'm going to call it good at that point. And I will share my number right now, and then I'll put it on the chat. It's area code 918-671-3888.